Hello and welcome to episode number 14 of the Internet Storm Center podcast. My name is Joel Essler of SourceFire and of joelessler.net. And with me, as always, is Johannes Ulrich of Sands.
Hey, Joel. Great for being together again on a podcast.
Hey, imagine that we should actually find time to get together to do one of these wonderful things. Yeah. So we're doing a little bit different of a record this week. Hopefully the quality will be a little bit better for you guys. We're not relying on Skype as much, so got a bunch of topics we want to cover, but anything we want to cover first there, Johannes?
I don't have a preference. We have a bunch of good stuff. We could start with configers, have a little wrap-up of that. You know, it's kind of an old topic by now somewhat, but I think we probably should wrap it up a little bit and talk about some of the aftermath.
Yeah, let's beat that to death. So what we got? We got Conficker. Okay, so for those of you that have been living in a cardboard box for the past, 6 months or so, Conficker is this worm that has been spreading around Microsoft Windows machines using various exploits of basically one is the MS08067 vulnerability. I think it came out in October, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And there are a couple versions, and the latest one that got everybody's panties up in a knot was the C version that had like this April 1st magic update date.
That's right, the April 1st magic execute date that did absolutely nothing, apparently.
Yeah, and it really appeared to be just sort of a little ruse here in this worm, because it really had a P2P mechanism to update. That was actually used then a couple of days later. But kind of what it really caused was a lot of worry about nothing. I kind of liked it, actually, because it also caused a lot of systems to get patched and antiviruses to get updated and such.
Yeah, this worm was really a doozy. It was definitely written by a professional programmer. I mean, it wasn't just your run-of-the-mill script kiddie worm here. This one was a good one. I mean, it had P2P. It talked to other machines on the same local network. It spread through the internet. It infected. I don't know what the final estimated count was for Conficker, but it was in the millions of machines.
Yeah, I think I've seen good numbers, numbers I believe that were sort of in the 10 to 20 million range. However, sort of around April 1st, really, there were only 1 or 2 million left. In part, it sort of killed itself with all the publicity being caused. Because now that caused people then to actually look for it.
Yeah, the thing about the Conficker worm was, and did you know if that April's Fool story, or I don't know if it was an April Fool story, but it was a story about the apparently two people that got arrested for writing it. Was that an April Fool story, or was that true, or don't we know?
Yeah, that was an April Fool story. It was supposedly a Ukrainian official or so said that. It's another case out of the sometimes fairly strange Russian, Eastern European humor that manifests itself like that. Similar to the guy that admitted that he launched or controlled a denial of service attack on Estonia and such. That's basically just the way they make jokes there. So
okay. Yeah, I didn't hear any more about that when I didn't hear any more about that when that came out. So I didn't know if that was true or not, or what the story was with that. So. Yeah. What's our lesson learned from this one? What's our lesson learned? Adrian wrote a diary for the Internet Storm Center today that actually had a bunch of really good bullet points in it. Mm-hmm. So it talked about the methods that Conficker used to propagate, and then he had 5 or 6, 7 points here that you know, lessons learned from Conficker. You know, make sure the antivirus software is very up to date. Make sure that, you know, your on-access scanning is turned on. Disable auto run on your machines. Ensure your machines are patched for MS08067. Ensure that all privileged accounts have very strong passwords and things like that. So, kind of the general, 4, 5, 6 steps that should be done, around the world. But the problem is with home machines and not properly administrated, Windows machines out there, that a lot of these types of, general best practice points kind of slip through the cracks there for Conficker. And, ended up, you know, where we were with the big mess that, you know, it wound up being. So,
yeah, one thing that actually I found interesting on this little analysis, that a reader actually wrote in, he works for a university security department. And one thing they found is that not too many systems actually got infected via the vulnerability, the MS-0867 vulnerability, but most of them got infected via other ways, like, you know, the brute force passwords or shared USB drives and things like that. So, one of the big questions also with Configure was, the US actually got away pretty easy on that one. Particularly Asia got hit a lot harder than the US. And, you know, maybe people have patching down here by now. People have auto-patching enabled on Windows, which is probably one of the big things people can do, home users can do on their systems, and enable or do not disable auto-patching.
Yeah, that's, you know, hopefully, you know, the world and at large is getting better at patching and things like that. With just all the threats that are out there nowadays, you know, people are just generally getting smarter, I've noticed. But, you know, then you've got, you know, people upgrading to the new operating system. So I don't know. There's a bunch of the, you know, I think the world's getting smarter about these type of things. I mean, no matter what, you know, we do, the quote unquote bad guys will always find a way around what we're doing. So it's, you know, it's kind of a cat and mouse type of game, as it were. But I think people are generally getting better at patching. So,
and there's still a $250,000 bounty out on the Configure author. So if you want to make some extra money, I don't know if it's dead or alive. Or
well, speaking,
mail the hat, the head of the Configure author to Bill Gates and get $250,000.
There you go. Now, speaking of bounties, I found it was something interesting. Did you? This isn't one of our topics, but you just reminded me of it. Was that AT&T put out a bounty for whoever cut that fiber line out there in California not too long ago?
I heard that. Yeah. Actually, I thought that good that you mentioned it. That was kind of an interesting story. I thought that they only cut fiber in one particular location, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And actually caused some significant damage. So that entire redundancy didn't seem to be quite there where people may expect it.
Well, here's the interesting thing that I find about it was that, you know, they were cut in very specific places. People knew, whoever cut it knew exactly where to cut it. So that either makes me think it's kind of like an inside job or someone who's really mapped out the fiber, you know, some kind of professional entity that really knows where all the fiber is out there. And actually what was interesting was that, yes, that was one of the cuts, but there was like three cuts that happened. There was one in California, there was one in like South or North Carolina, and then there was another one I heard about in the Virginia area. So they all happened right about the same time and, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. I just found that kind of interesting.
A little bit like these undersea cables last year, if you remember that story. You know, that's kind of like that. But in the past, that has happened with sort of insiders, you know, where, like during labor disputes or so, that some rogue employees went out and cut fiber. So that sometimes happens. You usually can tell if they were professional or not, like, you know, whether they take the slack out of the fiber or whether they just cut it. Haven't really heard anything about that, but it took them quite a while to fix it.
Yeah, it did. And, it was very interesting, I thought, that, you know, just about the specific of where they cut it and things like that. I thought that was highly interesting. But anyway, yeah, so there's still a bounty out for that. we'll see. What else do we have on the agenda here? Let's see. We got point number two on our list here, which is Snort 2.8.4.
Yes, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? You're Mr. Snort here, so
Mr. Snort. Yeah. We talked about it actually the last podcast that we did. Is that I said that it was going to come out soon, that you had to upgrade now, and when it came out, I actually happened to be the handler on duty that day, which was quite an interesting coincidence. But the when it came out, I did my best that day to put it up on my blog, to put it out on Twitter, to put it out on everything that I could. And the reason why we feel at SourceFire, why we feel that this is such an important update, is because basically we're saying that this is a huge important update because VRT, our vulnerability research team at SourceFire, is not putting out updates for NetBIOS rules if you do not have 284 anymore. Basically, you have to upgrade to 284 to continue being covered under the NetBIOS or the NetBIOS category. The reason for that is because SourceFire / Snort developers introduced a new preprocessor that we call the DCE RPC2 preprocessor. And what it is it's a target-based preprocessor for NetBIOS for DCE RPC. So, for instance, why I say target-based is because, you know, Windows 2000 will handle NetBIOS differently than Samba will, and different versions of Samba, different versions of Windows, things like that. So this is more along the lines of our target-based technology that we have that we've already had taken place in other portions of the product, but this is taking it all the way into the application level, which is the DCE RPC. So the reason for that is because the NetBIOS rule category, if you were a Snort follower and downloaded our rules, was getting up in the 4,000 and 5,000 rule range, which is a lot. And what happened is after this preprocessor, let me back up. The reason for that is because we have to do there's a lot of flow tracking that has to take place with our rules and flow bit setting and unsetting and checking to see if flow bits are set and things like that. And we're just modeling the protocols, basically what the rules were doing. Well, when it got up to the 4,000 and 5,000 rule range, we kind of said, wait a minute, we have to take a step back and let's see if there's a more efficient way we can do this. So the preprocessor was written. Basically, it does all the flow checking and making sure they're valid DCE RPC sessions and things like that. And then what happens after that is that basically all you have to do within the rule is call a keyword or call a keyword with an interface number, something like that, and it'll recognize the output out of the back end, the decoded portion of the DCE RPC2 preprocessor, so that basically, the 90 or 100, for instance, let's take the 08067 vulnerability that came out that Conficker was using. We were just talking about that. The original rule set had 168 rules to look for that particular vulnerability. And after the rewrite, there was 4.
Yeah.
So
now, does it basically do things where it sort of, check state or so within the preprocessor? So if a rule requires or an exploit requires that you're connected as an authenticated user or something like that, that this is already part of the rule? Or what does it kind of do there?
Well, it does. Let's talk about state in two different methods. First of all, this first state that we can talk about is TCP state. And we know that's already taken place within the stream preprocessor. The other portion of it is what you were talking about with the authenticated sessions and things like that. It's basically making sure that the session is valid within the exchange between two SMB clients. It also does things like I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. This is kind of – it's a little tricky, but it also does some things like write and X and that kind of segmentation and fragmentation within SMB layers and things like that. So there's several things that it does, several things that it tracks, but basically the whole important portion of it is that it's able to – basically make our rule set from the big monstrous thing that it was down to a very small set. And, we went from 4,000 or 5,000 rules down to, I think, just under 200 or something like that. So the size of our rule set came way down, and that not only relieves a lot of stress on the rule developers, but also relieves a lot of stress on our users, so they don't have to track and maintain 5,000 some rules with flow bits and things like that.
And I assume it's more efficient on the CPU to
yeah,
run the preprocessor. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot more. It's preprocessors generally run faster than a rule state will, just because it's in C code and this, that, and the other thing, but. Yeah, it does execute a lot faster than a normal flow tracking rule would, which you know, when it comes to IPS and IDS detection, speed is king, right?
Yeah, and I remember actually, you know, these flow bit rules, because you keep mentioning them in the intrusion detection class. We use sort of some of these rules as examples for flow bits, and they're definitely one of the more complex rules we discuss in the class. And it's always where you see sort of the couple brains pop there in class,
where the eyes glaze over.
Those are definitely very messy rules, yeah, because you have so much traffic on these Windows ports, you know, 4.4.5, or so. You have to be really specific on what you're looking for. If you're just looking for some random exploit strings or so, you're bound to find them even in a random document that's being transferred or something like that.
Well, and the fun part about NetBIOS is it doesn't necessarily stick to those standard ports, right? It negotiates it negotiates the exchange, and then it'll jump up to some high port above 1025, and you have to the thing with the preprocessor is that it has a feature that has auto-detect, so it will detect it when it jumps up, and it does NetBIOS up on those high ports and things like that. But, yeah, NetBIOS is a very interesting protocol. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we have to do to detect it.
Yeah. The thing that sort of got me excited on Snort 284 was that in IPv6, it finally supports fragmentation, which is, you know, what's missing so far. And that's definitely a good step forward to have a bit more IPv6 support in Snort. And it's still fairly basic, but, you know, all the application stuff for now is supported in IPv6. So... definitely, it's coming together nicely.
Yeah, it's building up towards, you know. Well, I don't know if have you taken a look at the Snort 3 beta?
Very little. I'm about to compile it. Actually, I'm just compiling 284 here while we are on the conference on the podcast call here. But I looked at 3. I looked at some of the architecture stuff. Do you think it's something that you know, in particular as a home user, that's sort of ready to play with?
Well, here's the thing is that, you know, Snort 3, I would definitely start taking a look at it. If you run Snort as a day-to-day job, you run Snort at home, things like that, you're interested in seeing what's going on, I would start playing with it now, because the reason for that is because the game's changing in the IDS world. And basically, Snort 3 is taking, you know, where we're at in Snort, and it's leapfrogging the technology 5 years. You know, it's going into the multiprocessor. It's going into, you know, we don't have to restart an IPS instance anymore. We don't have to do this, that, and the other thing. So we're doing a lot of things with Snort 3 that's just basically taking our taking the IDS, the IPS, the Snort technology, and just jumping forward like crazy.
Yeah, I remember sort of 5 years or so ago when Marty was sort of, you know, justifying why Snort is single-threaded. It made perfect sense back then, but now really, you know, with multi-core processes and such, you really, you know, a single-threaded process doesn't really make sense anymore.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing with, you know, that's a big thing with Snort 3 is the multi-threaded, multi-core, things like that. So there's a lot of work being done in that area. We're working with, you know, Marty's talked about working with Intel directly. And you know, this information about Snort 3 is on Marty's blog, but it's a really good read, really good information. So I encourage you to take a look at that. But the Snort 3, what I was talking about with Snort 3 is the IPv6, things like IPv6 and GRE and even MPLS decoding, all that stuff is all native right into the engine now. It was built with that. All the decoders for all those were built from the ground up when Marty was writing Snort 3. So,
I think we just had a gold paper. I think it's in the reading room now that discusses Snort 3. It's probably a good reference for people to look at if you're interested in sort of a concise reference on what's new in Snort 3.
That's right. Yeah. Doug Burks, friend of mine actually out of Augusta, Georgia. He wrote a paper on Snort 3, but he took it a step further. He actually built his own live CD that you can download, and it's actually in his paper. So, yeah, if you go to the gold paper room or the reading room and check that paper out, it takes you step by step on how to set up Snort 3. Snort 3 is also being referred – the official name of it is Snort SP, or Snort Security Platform, or SSP. But everybody keeps referring it to as Snort 3, but it's officially called the Snort Security Platform, so I guess I should start calling it that.
Yeah, marketing stuff.
Yeah, that's true. It's a fine product. I need to really get into learning it more. You know, I set it up, I've got it working and things like that, but I really need to learn the ins and outs of it, especially if I'm going to be deploying the technology. So,
yep.
But, yeah, so if you're on anything earlier than Snort 2.8.4, go update right now.
Yep, definitely do that. And what else do we have, actually? A Microsoft Patch Week was this week, right?
That's right.
Tons of patches.
Yeah, there was a
actually
bunch.
Quite exciting this week.
I don't know if Microsoft patches are exciting per se. But yeah, it really did cover a bunch of things. You got everything from Excel, you got WordPad, you got DirectX, you got Windows, you got IE, I mean the ISA server. You got a whole bunch of things in this particular update.
Yeah. I had some journalist ask me today, you know, whether we're making headway in security or not, in software security in particular. And she put a little bit of that Microsoft patch set as evidence that we don't make headway. Well, I don't know. You can say that we make headway because we find all these bugs. And I'm not really sure how many of them were found with new tools or just with fuzzers or whatever. But a lot of this, I think, is really still legacy code sort of sitting around. It doesn't really necessarily reflect on the code that's written at Microsoft today, what they're publishing as patches today.
Yeah, I really have to take my hat off to Microsoft because they're really doing a good job with the patching coming out on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Good patches coming out. Software. Everybody's got problems with software. It's an ever changing, rotating game and things like that. But Microsoft's doing a really good job of being patching, getting out there, and really staying current. And I recently took an exploitation class taught by our vulnerability research team at Sourcefire, and it's a new class that they're putting out. It's called exploit development, and we learned a lot of things. And one of the questions that one of the students asked Lorene, who is basically, she's not a defender at our company. She doesn't defend anything. She's an offensive professional. And, one of the students in the class asked Lorene, said, hey, what's the best operating system? And she flat out answered Vista.
But Vista seems to have its act together if you don't open it up again. Yeah? And now you can disable all kinds of protections and make it vulnerable. And as a user, of course, a lot of the exploits we see coming in, I mentioned it earlier with Configure, they're not really exploiting any technical vulnerability. They make you click on stuff, or they make you install it by inserting a USB stick and things like that. Now, that's really how a lot of the exploits happen these days.
That's right, yeah. It's my hat's off to Microsoft right now. They're doing an excellent job, and I hope they keep it up. And I hope more vendors follow Microsoft's example with the patch release cycle and things like that. So,
yeah, I always say, if you're lame, if you don't know how to code, go to the offensive side. Don't bother with coding. If you really know what you're doing, then you want to go into coding, because the problem with the coder really is that you have to get it right every single time. You have to write 1,000 functions. Every one of these 1,000 functions has to be right. On the offensive side, you find one function where the developer messed up, and you win, and you're the hero. Yeah? But the defensive side is really, where you need to think, and where you need to innovate, and have your act together. For the offensive side, you need to have one good day, and on the defensive side, if you have one bad day, you have a problem.
Well, it isn't. I would agree in part in saying that it could be the defensive side is also difficult, but not so much the defensive side, but I would say the preventative side. when you're, you know, you're writing code to prevent problems. It would be, I think that would be harder than the offensive side. But, you know, the offensive side, you know, like you said, you know, you find it takes a lot of research to get what you're doing. But once you find, you know, once you find that call or you find that function call or you find where you can overwrite the stack or overwrite a heap or things like that, you know, like you said, your day is made from there on out.
Yeah, and yeah, usually you don't even have to really exploit it. Like, you know, sometimes there are vulnerabilities where it's somewhat questionable whether they can actually be exploited. In particular now with Vista, where they put all the, you know, additional protections in. I don't know if you remember the CanSec West bug they found in Explorer, which in Explorer 8, which actually turned out wouldn't be exploitable in the final version of Explorer 8 because the beta version didn't have all the Stack Overflow protection turned on.
Right. Yeah, so they're doing a good job. Keep it up.
Yep.
Good job, Microsoft. I never thought I'd say that, but I still don't like their operating system. I still won't use it, but they're doing a hell of a good...
They just have to make it cool now. I'm still struggling with that.
Still won't use it. Still don't like it, but they're doing a good job of patching. I'll put it that way.
Now, while we're talking about software, Twitter had its little issue there, too.
Oh, Twitter, yeah. Let's talk about Twitter. Every podcast in the world has to talk about Twitter for a half hour. Let's talk about Twitter right quick in the terms of the security portion of it. So basically what happened is that this guy wrote a cross-site scripting exploit, actually. And this guy's name, I'm trying to remember this dude's name. I can't remember his name. Matt or Michael, Mikey? Was it Mikey? Something like
whatever.
That.
Whatever. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So basically this guy, he wrote this cross-site scripting exploit. And basically what it did was it said, you know, some random string. I don't know if it was random, but it said, you know, I love, and then this guy's website, which I'm not going to say because I don't want to give him any plugs. But basically, it said, you know, this website, and it pointed people directly to his own website. And then he came out like a couple hours later and said, yeah, I did it. It was me.
Yeah. And actually what he did is cross-site scripting in the location field. In Twitter, you have the option to basically post where you are at. And there are little applications like the iPhone where it sort of automatically updates with the GPS data from the iPhone. But what he did is he found a cross-site scripting vulnerability in that particular field. And the way he exploited it was adding some JavaScript to this location field that whenever somebody was looking at his location, that JavaScript would then trigger a request from the user's browser to add this location to that particular user's profile. So it was cross-site scripting with cross-site request forging, which is always sort of a deadly combination. Cross-site request forging doesn't really work too well, at least sort of in this more complex form, unless you do also have cross-site scripting. So that's what happened to Twitter. Then there were a couple of follow-on sort of copycat forms, and it took Twitter a while to fix it, which was a little bit sad. But, well, you know, it's a complex website, and so they can't fix things like this, like, you know, I fix on my websites and by just logging into a live site and fixing it.
Yeah, this guy, I don't know. He's a really bold guy. He points people to his own website, and then if you go, it's funny. I actually heard about this on another podcast as well. But it's funny because if you go to his website and you look at Twitter's website, it's the exact same website. I mean, like the terms of service are exactly the same. Yeah, the dude copy and pasted everything from Twitter and put it into his website. Oh, well. Yeah,
maybe they go after him somehow. I don't know. What he did was definitely not right. There was the first form like this. It was like the basic Sammy form. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
For MySpace?
Yeah.
Which was sort of the classic problem. You know, we're all geeks and we don't have any friends. So Sam he was really good at JavaScript, which meant he had even less of a chance of having any friends. So what he did was write a similar exploit like this, to basically get himself friends, you know, to whenever somebody visited Sam's website or Sam's profile, it would then add him as a friend and add his little script to that person's website. I think he had like 2 million friends or so within a day. This new Twitter worm actually was not all that terribly successful, but I think because you had to actually look at the location. So if you read Twitter via an RSS feed or so, you weren't necessarily exposed to it.
I don't think it actually did anything except just post that his website on your status. Okay. I don't think it actually compromised your password or anything like that. But
yeah. Well, so yet another little web exploit. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Name them, write them down. There's so many of them.
Yeah.
What else do we got here? Let's look at our list.
Adobe.
Oh, let's talk about the Adobe. Okay,
any Adobe exploits? There has to be an Adobe exploiter.
Yeah, there's got to be. So let me talk about this meeting. The DojoSec, if you're not familiar with DojoSec, let me start off by that. It's dojosec.com, DojoSec.com. And what it is, it's basically like an information systems security association, a local security organization within the BWI area. And the last
BWI
meeting,
it's Baltimore.
Yeah, Baltimore, Washington, Annapolis, that kind of area there. So what happened is we went over to Capital College, which is not too far away from Columbia, Maryland, and not too far away from that area, but went to Capital College, and we all kind of sat in, and they had three talks. One was by Rob Fuller, another one was by Joe McCrae, and the third one was by our own Matt Wachinski of VRT at Sourcefire. And all three of the talks were pretty good. It was kind of funny because all the three talks that existed were from speakers that I knew personally, which was a little strange. The third talk, like I said, was about the Adobe exploit or the Adobe Zero Day that Sourcefire put out. I don't know what was it, back in February. And it put it out on our blog put it out on VRT's blog. Back in February, and it was covered pretty heavily in the media and things like that. But what was the interesting part for me during the briefing was, you know, Matt told the story of how, you know, the vulnerability was discovered and how, you know, we chose to, or VRT chose to put it out there and things like that. But the interesting part for me was at the end, you know, there's always a technical segment at the end of any good technical briefing. And at the end of this particular technical segment, while the presentation was running, Matt had a fuzzer that VRT had written that basically you can fuzz almost any file and any program with it. And what he was doing during the presentation, he was fuzzing just some random PDF that he pulled off of Adobe's website, and he was fuzzing it while the presentation was being given in the background. And, you know, at the end of the briefing, he minimized his presentation, and up came his laptop, and there it was, you know. And just during that briefing, he had found 4 zero days during that briefing, just on some random PDF that he pulled down. So, you know, I if you want to go ahead and take a look at the briefing, it's on the DojoSec website, DojoSec.com. It's right there at the very top. But it was a really good briefing. I encourage you to take a look at it. I was talking about this with somebody else, and they said, okay, well, if there's a zero day in Adobe, and there's zero days in Fox Pro, and there's zero days in this and zero days in that, what do you recommend? And a friend of mine gave me a good recommendation. I re-asked the question to a friend of mine, and a friend of mine gave me a good recommendation and said, hey, take the PDF, email it to yourself on your Google account, and then use Google's open as an HTML feature.
Yeah, that's
kind of
nice, yeah.
And they said, let Google's servers deal with it. Don't deal with it on your own machine.
Compromise Google.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Like, I thought about using, they're like these PDF to HTML, PDF to text, whatever, converters. Some of them also can do PDF to PDF. which kind of makes sense because, you know, it basically takes the document apart and puts it back together and hopefully puts it back together in sort of a standard compliant way. But most of those tools use the actual Adobe libraries or some open source libraries that basically do the same thing. And during the parsing phase of these libraries, you can, of course, you know, compromise your own system.
Right.
It's not that it really isolates you from the exploit.
Yeah, the very, you know, very good, interesting stuff out there about the, you know, all the PDF vulnerabilities. And hopefully, you know, people like Adobe, people like, you know, Fox Pro, things like that, hopefully they get their, you know, stuff together. The problem is with PDF is that the standard, the PDF standard is so strangely written. It's really a weird.
It's like this stuff with no JavaScript as part of the standard and such. It's a very complex format. And the other problem I have with PDFs is you receive so many of them. Like, you know, it's not that you cannot accept PDFs. It's almost considered the safe standard format in some ways, compared to Office formats and things like this, which also have their problems. But
oh yeah, I agree. It's, you know, it's. Let's face it. You know, if there's a file out there, if there's a program out there, there's going to be a vulnerability on it. It's just a matter of time till it's found. That's all it is. Yeah. So you're not safe. No one's safe.
Mm. Yep.
So,
what else do we have? Anything? I think that's of the basic stuff we wanted to cover. Now, actually, one thing is next week is RSA, right? And RSA is always the big security industry power where you have all these great keynotes which don't really say much for the most part, but everybody attends them, and then they're big quoted about, you know, whatever new concepts they come up with. Probably Microsoft will again talk about end-to-end security and all that good stuff. I know Marty probably talking there too at some point.
I think he is, actually. I don't know the exact schedule, but I'm pretty sure he is, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like on one panel sort of toward the end. I think it's the last day, Thursday, of the conference, and I'll be teaching a SANS class Sunday and Monday, sort of a pre-conference class dev. But what do you think? Anything changed since last year, or are we pretty much stuck in the same situation as last year?
Well, I know, you know, there's been a couple talks recently about I'm trying to think. There's been a couple talks recently about, like, taking over the internet and things like that with BGP and what else? What was the other thing I was just saw the other day? Where did it come out? Black Hat Europe, I was thinking.
There was, like, a TCP, but it's old stuff. That's sort of the
– yeah.
I call it always the tar pointing in reverse where you go to a server, you send the SYN, you get the SYN ACK back, you send the ACK, and then you hold the connection. People have talked for that. Like, I remember talking to Mike Poor about that, like, you know, 2 years ago or so. I don't really see a huge problem there with this particular. It's defendable. It's nothing I'm that terribly concerned about. It's just that current default configurations may not be quite ready for that. I don't know. I don't think the internet itself is at any more risk than it was before.
Unless you cut fiber cables.
Yeah, unless you cut fiber cables. And you know, that also is kind of an old exploit. There still has to be, I guess, more resilience to the internet itself. But that's, of course, a cost issue, and everybody likes to have their internet access cheap. So that's not going to change unless people actually pay for it. Now, any other issues? One thing I was actually thinking about is, you know, we talk a lot about software security. I think one thing where I see some change is that the tools, the developer tools, are becoming better.
I agree.
The developer tools are actually now more security aware and direct the developer into a direction that's more secure. The problem I still see is that a lot of developers don't know those tools, like don't know that there are these libraries and such they can use to basically create more secure code easily.
Right. I do agree with you that the developer tools are getting better. I will agree with you there, yeah. But
And then I think a problem you really have to solve is passwords, and I don't see a solution for that. passwords just don't work, and any other solution so far is really more an insular solution, like tokens or so. You can use that for a couple websites, but there is no, like, you know, universal token or something like that, and I don't see that anywhere on the horizon.
Are you an advocate of the passphrase?
Yes, I am. But I'm also working a little bit on a passphrase cracker that instead of using a dictionary, just, you know, combines words of a dictionary. And I think there are common passphrases, like, you know, passphrase people like to use. First sentence of the Constitution seems to be very popular with people.
Oh, really?
And I think, you know, hackers will learn these common passphrases. I think it's something, you know, where your most important control is the human, you know, and that usually doesn't go over well. But I don't see a solution at this point. Biometrics is not a solution either.
It doesn't matter what the coders do. There's no fix for the human stupidity. So
yeah, and I think there has to be something like universal token or whatever. But you know, how do you protect that? That's, you know, everybody getting a certificate or something like that. That maybe work, but who is the certificate authority? And all of these things are there are really a lot of political human issues that have to be solved first before anything like this can work.
Right. I don't know. Do you think the certificate model is broken as well? Or,
well, the certificate model is broken in two ways. First of all, it all hinges on the certificate authority doing what you think it's doing. And quite frankly, they don't. You know, quite frankly, the certificate authority is, again, cheapest bidder. You can go to VeriSign, just to name a company, and get your extended validation certificate for $2,000, right. Or you can go to GoDaddy and get an SSL certificate for $20. Doesn't really matter to the end user much. And then, you know, there are a lot of these SSL exploits now, where essentially what you do is you just remove the SSL component. Like there's a little SSL proxy thing, Moxie, he wrote that. And right. What it basically does is just strips the HTTPS links and replaces them with HTTP links. Well, the user doesn't care because there is no warning when you go to an HTTP website.
Well, it's a man in the middle attack,
generally. If you go to a website with a broken SSL certificate, then there's a big warning. So I think SSL, it's technically not broken. The implementation, again, the human part of it is broken.
Right. That was a man in the middle attack, that SSL thing,
yep,
wasn't it?
And I think it's sort of ingeniously simple. It's sort of one of these little small tricks that really get you off balance.
Right. Yeah. It's you know, like I said, it doesn't matter what we do. It's they're gonna come and get you, I guess. I don't know.
Last year at RSA, you know, there were tons and tons of vendors that did sort of identity management and such. But again, you know, it's really more a corporate network thing. That's nothing global. And I have to see how many of them are still around this year.
Right. Yeah, hopefully, I don't know, like you said, going back to the RSA topic, I don't really know what talks are going on out this year. I don't know if there's anything big coming out this year at the RSA talk. I will not be there, unfortunately, but...
Well, actually, Sans has a booth there. I'll probably spend some time there if anybody wants to come by and visit. When I looked at the floor plan, it was all the way in the back right corner when you come in.
There you go.
A little booth for Sans and GIAC.
Bring your autograph book and Johannes will sign
I'll bring some Internet Storm Center stickers.
There you go. Yeah. Stop by and get a sticker.
Yeah. Put you have on to ask laptop. For them. I won't put them out there for everybody.
That's right. Put it out there. I mean, stop by, get a sticker, put it on your laptop. That'd be awesome.
SourceFire probably has a decent-sized booth there, I guess.
I don't know.
Do you get to touch Marty?
Yeah, that's right. You can come by and take a picture with Marty and get him to sign your T-shirt. Yep. Bring your little stuffed snort pigs that you got, and Marty will sign them for you.
They probably hand them out there, too, or the snort pigs.
Probably. I don't know. But, okay. Sounds good.
I think that's it for an hour. Do we have anything else?
What else do we got? Anything anything going on? No?
No, not really. Huh? Again, we also have the daily podcast, if you're interested in it, the Stormcast. different RSS feed, different iTunes feed. Just look for it on iTunes. It's probably the easiest way to find it.
Yeah, so what do you do? You wake up in the morning and record those?
Actually, I record them in the evening.
Oh, do you?
I record them before I go to bed. So for everybody, it will be basically something that you can listen to in the morning. I do it this way, so you know people in Europe also get it in the morning. And overnight, there's usually not that much that happens, and you don't really want to listen to me in the morning. So,
yeah, those the downloads for those have really taken off. I was looking at that the other day, you know, that's encouraging. And people, we've got lots of people that have written in, you know, saying, hey, you know, thanks for doing those. Those are great. We love them. Because a lot of people don't have time to read, but they have time to be able to just sync their iPhone right quick or sync their iPod right quick, and that's handy. So, okay, sounds good. Well, Johannes, thanks for getting together with me.
Thanks, Joel. Thanks. Yeah. And of course, thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, appreciate it. All right, catch you guys next time.